Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. Hope you're well. I am here with my great, great friend, Hugh Hendry. We are right here at Rebel Base Camp. I remember my first video I did with you. I welcomed him to the show, and that's where he came up with that term, Rebel Base Camp, which I thought was awesome. So, Hugh, welcome back to the show. Well, this is the first time I've had you on a live stream. So I'm really excited. We're going to take some calls. So Josh, why don't you go ahead and throw the link up there for people who want to ask you some questions directly. But you've come out with some Twitter threads in the last couple of weeks, and one of them was kind of channeling Atlas Shrugged and your view towards what's going on in the world with authoritarianism. And most people just see you as a brilliant macro thinker, which obviously you are, but you've got some views around freedom and liberty as well. So do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm rereading Atlas Shrugged. I mean, the first thing to say, George, is you know, people always ask me, what can I read? You know, how can I get my edge? Yeah, I used to have brokers from the big investment banks, and they call me, hey, listen, I want to share you, like, this is what we're putting down today. You know, I want to put you in front of people. I want to get you the edge. And I was like, the only edge that I seek is a meeting with the guy who plays guitar for U2. Okay, I don't want your edge. My edge came from a flippant, naive attitude, but it came from understanding that great art, and Atlas Shrugged is great art. I think it was released in either 1957 or 59, and it's 57. It's timeless, and sadly, it really resonates with our time. Right. It resonates with when you have the collective consumed by fear, then the collective becomes a tyrant, and it does dastly things. I mean, I am holed up. I promise not to eat any bananas. I know that upsets. When we did this, when we did our first encounter, I was eating a banana at Rebel Base Camp. But back then, I was in this beautiful luxury villa, and I've deconstructed, I've stripped it back to rebuild. But where am I going with that?
Are you in St. Bart's right now?
Oh, yeah, indeed. And so the St. Bart's and the tyranny, I'm holed up. I'm actually held. I'm being oppressed by the authorities because I had the audacity to arrive from the United Kingdom and the French. So St. Bart's, as you know, welcomes beautiful. It's the island of the blessed for the blessed. And you're welcome to arrive from anywhere in the world. And we had a good COVID. But I possibly some overtures from the fracture within Europe and the relationship between the Brits and the French at the political level. They came in and they've imposed a quarantine for anyone visiting from the United Kingdom. So I am on day 9 of a 10-day quarantine, and it's subject only to me, no one else. You can come from Brazil, Bogota, you can come from anywhere, but it's me. And then they have rules. Anyway, they have rules, and then no one obeys the rules. I mean, each night I'm rereading. I fear Atlas Shrugged is a long book, right. And I fear that I read it too young. You've got to live a life to recognize what she's really saying. You've got to be a man to fight the looters and the moochers. You know, you've got to be sure of yourself to say, I'm proud of what I've done. I'm proud of the money that I've made because it came from ingenuity. It came from, you know, working hard. It came from me. I deserved it, you know, and my views and this tyranny of, there's another tyranny, George, which is editorially, no one seems to be permitted to use the word deflation. It's not used. It's not used. It seems to, I don't know, somewhere in the late 60s, 70s, that word just seemed to have been erased because it has connotations with a bleak period when the political state had become impotent, where they kept pressing the dashboard. Hey, let's do fiscal policy. nothing. Let's devalue the dollar versus gold, kind of nothing, you know. Let's cut rates to nothing. Nothing worked. There had to be a passage of time, and we had to await the reawakening and the risk-taking, load-bearing capacity of the entrepreneur in it. And it took the best part of 2 decades. The Moochers want to tell you it required a war, which is nonsense. It required the entrepreneurial spirit to shrug off the bad stuff which had come to pass at the end of the 1920s, when we were all, I would maintain, we were all crucified on a cross of gold. You know, we had four central bankers, four guys ran the world. I mean, today is one guy, it's Jay Powell. And they had this gold standard, and until we broke it, we were held in a bad place.
Hugh, I know as a fund manager, one of the things you had to do is take into consideration the geopolitical environment at all times, and try to, you know, just kind of use game theory to figure out what the probabilities of XYZ occurring, so then you could make a trade around that, or you could set up your portfolio around that. So when you're looking around the world today from a standpoint of geopolitics, you see all of these moves towards authoritarianism. We see what's happening in Europe with Germany coming in and trying to implement these mandates. Australia, I just watched a video the other day with that one particular psychopath guy. I don't know if he's a local governor or something like that. He's now making it illegal for people who are unvaccinated to leave their house for any reason other than just to get food. They can't even go outside to exercise. If you were to put on your fund manager hat, how do you see the world, and how do you assess this move towards authoritarianism? Or do you see kind of light at the end of the tunnel from the standpoint of this recent variant is probably far more mild, and it could be the end of the pandemic, and maybe the markets aren't pricing that in yet?
I think the markets are trying desperately to price it in every day. They're trying to price it in to say, oh, it's done, it's behind us, let's party again. The markets, I think, really are desperately trying to do that. I have to caution you that I hear the geopolitical and review and analysis of at the geopolitical level, and you would think that is very much in harmony with the prevalence of global macro, but that was really not and is not my, if I have a skill set, my skill set is either Dadaism or it's absurdity. People look and anticipate for rational outcomes. I always pushed the other way. I always said, what's the most absurd thing that can happen? Why did I do that? I did that because there's a huge return on calling that right. And they do happen. And I came to reflect upon it today, a moment of absurdity, which seems to be very relevant to today. So today, let's talk about today, because I get criticized for talking about yesterday. Sure. Today, we are 40 years into the greatest bull market in modern history, which is the treasury bond bull market. You know, in 1982, yields peaked at, let's call it 16%. And in the midst of the body snatching COVID invasion, they were less than 50 basis points. And so the price, of course, is the inverse of that. So the price has been dramatic, but that doesn't even give you half of the impression of just how powerful it has been, because we've talked about this persistent trend higher and higher over 4 decades in what is what we term the risk-free asset. So actually, people have been leveraged long for 4 decades, something which has just kept giving. Okay, and so all things end. And there's a great presumption today that the end is nigh, okay? And that's rational. And I want to accept and acknowledge that things come to an end, but endings or bookends, I think, are characterized by, let's use my favorite word, absurdity. So to give you an example, real world example, we are inoculated by the passage of time. But where we took a back to 1979, when Volcker started to raise interest rates, you could scarcely believe what was happening. It would be as if the Fed had been taken hostage by a crazy mad person. And I say that because we were in the midst of the second oil price, embargo, and therefore the second major economic downturn of the decade of the 1970s. The first, 1973-74, had been the most profound economic downturn since the Depression. It was, peak to trough, it was of a magnitude of an order greatly different from others. So we knew what was coming. Bad things were coming. And this guy was raising interest rates. And here we are, we're discussing that the Fed almost certainly will, raise interest rates by 25 basis points. He raised rates by 1 percentage point. And he did it on a Saturday morning. And he said, hey, guys, mic drop, see you on Monday morning when we start trading again. Like crazy. So, and again, so that's 79. Let's go to like the culmination there. In the summer of 1982, inflation was on its way out. I mean, that wasn't a hunch. That was a fact. It was, we were in the midst of a severe economic contraction. Bank lending had just dried up and the economy was going down and inflation was collapsing. Steinhardt, the legendary macro trader, he had wisely shifted his asset allocation to favor 10-year treasuries. But what happened? The yield continued its trend. It went higher and higher and higher, hitting 16% as the inflation rate went lower, 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 lower. That's absurd. Steinhardt was being sued by his investors. They're like, whoa, this style drift. We liked it when you were the equity guy. But what are you doing buying treasuries at 16% yield? That's absurd.
What year was that? You was that 81? 82, okay.
82. I mean, he was buying from 1980, but he bought and he leveraged up over 2 years. But
yeah, for those who don't know who Michael Steinhardt is, I believe he was one of the first people interviewed by Jack Schwager for the Market Wizards books, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he was a macro wizard.
Legend.
You know, he's of the Soros age generation,
right.
Chopped up compound gains in excess of 20% per annum, and ultimately, of course, he's an obdurate SOB, and he told the clients where to go, and he hung on, and the legend continued. So when I look at today, I can imagine that bond market coming to an end. But the absurdity in my mind says you're not going to read about that by these crazy, well, not crazy, by these dull people who write financial columns. Mm. And everyone's telling you. You're not going to read it there. Okay. I think the path to the piercing, the puncturing of the bull market in treasuries will actually be lower interest rates, not higher, which is to say that you would be right now in the passage of time to short those treasuries. But the journey of the next 2 years is going to take you to hell. Another example, I was one of the first macro managers to capture the change in the gold market in 2003. I made 50% calendar year for the hedge fund. And I nearly never made it, George. I nearly never made it. Yeah. So first of all,
you nearly never made the trade. Is that what you're saying?
No, I had the trade and it nearly killed me. I want to say to you is that markets are misanthropes, and they build profound fortresses around future profits. Yeah. And you've got to show that you are worthy of taking that path. And so the market has to test your resolve. So I was buying gold after, heavens, so 2002, a 20-year bear market, it had lost, 70-odd% of its nominal value when the S&P had climbed either 6 or 10 times. So I mean, the opportunity to had been devastated, and I saw it. It was turning. All my indicators said we had to do it. I leveraged up because, you know, in this business you need kahunas, and then it, you know, Atlas shrugged and went, and I lost 20% in 2 months, and my clients were like, this guy's crazy. This guy's crazy. But I traded it. I traded it. I persevered, and boom, I made 50%. So if you are a bond bear, you may be right. But all I would say to you is hang on to your breeches because the ride's going to be bumpy. And then lastly, the point that if this bond market is to change, you have to reconsider two things. Inflation is a monetary phenomenon, so we are not seeing inflation today. And then this is why the 10-year Treasury bond yield is, what is it, 1.75 or so percent?
Yeah.
And yet prices supposedly are rising at, you know, 40-year highs. So the market is saying, no. And that's because the market recognizes it's a monetary phenomenon. The Federal Reserve does not print money. I'm sure everyone at Rebel Base Camp understands that it's private sector banks. Yeah. Private sector banks are not printing money.
Yeah, in fact, secondly, I just talked to Snyder. The last hour, I had Snyder on live.
Jeff, I at some point I got to catch up with Jeff. I'm nothing but a cheap showbiz bum versus Jeff. But no,
the reason I said that though, because you know he reiterates that all the time that it's about what Friedman taught us back in the 70s is that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon.
Mm. Well, I have the audacity to want to kind of carve out an extra clause in that statement. As you know, we discussed it the last time we sat down to discuss things, that inflation, I think, it needs the transmission of the monetary mechanism, but it also needs the transmission of men and ladies' minds. And then we have to turn mad. We have to turn in on ourselves. The dawn of chaos. I wrote a paper in 2020. If you visit my website, you'll be offered a free copy of it. And I lay out the path. If inflation will come because we become a divided group, and of course the entrails of that are everywhere. And we discussed how everything kind of the tea leaves all seem to come. There's a confluence of events which cluster around the next U.S. election, and God forbid that, you know, this malign influence that's deep within us, God forbid that it doesn't heal. If it's set to continue, we were talking about the rise and rise of fascism. If it's set to continue, then it truly is the dawn of chaos.
When you use the term fascism, how are you defining that? Are you talking about there being more and more of a connection between government and corporations?
No.
Okay.
I mean, Putain is an offensive French slang term for F you all. And it could easily be mistaken for the leader of Russia. He's a fascist.
Mm.
Okay. But kind of he's an annoying circus act who doesn't really have a platform, and so he has to kind of throw his toys at us to try and get us to kind of entertain him with everything that's happening in the border of Ukraine. The malaise, which really the fascist malaise that I refer to, is the encroachment of the mercantilism of China on our world at large, and it has to be pushed back. And what it's doing is that the working state, the endeavors of people who work hard and they're good people in the sovereign of China, they are not compensated in line with their productivity. They're given a raw deal. Yeah, that's why, and they're forced to save because either in nominal terms or when you adjust for the currency, China and its flight path is more uncertain today than it has been in 10, 12 years. And we know the reason. The reason is the property market, the bubble in the property market. They put a bubble in the property market because when you don't pay people enough, they don't spend as much as we do. And so there's a hole that's left in the economy. And that's being filled in order to hit the mandate of GDP growth. It's been held, but it's been filled by the preposterous nature of their, you know, property is four times GDP. That's preposterous. And the value of property is preposterous. And it's a function of not paying people the right level. Now, it's worse than that because it continues to take income out of our system. You know, the US continues to have leakage into China in terms of the prosperity of, let's be pompous and call it the working class, of all of us. You know, it drains the endeavors of the working man. And so it leads us all in this path of lower and lower incomes, which requires more and more debt. So if you will, I fear that we're becoming serfs to the Chinese state because no one is willing to intervene and say this has got to stop. This model is enfranchising a tiny number of technocrats and these billionaire guys, and it's at the expense of the poverty of the many. And it's not that we have to change that just because we're taking a right or wrong kind of moral perspective. We have to change it because if left unchecked, then we will enter into a post-capitalist world. We're already in a mild deflationary environment. People in the younger generation are questioning how we organize our affairs. And there will be a revolution. They will push us aside unless we stop, like I say, the malaise and the march of the fascist and the fascist mercantilist state of China.
How, let's just say that we were able to, if I'm hearing you correctly, you're able to wave the magic wand and all of a sudden the yuan becomes a free floating currency. So it's more market force driven, and this increases the level of consumption in China so they don't have to overcompensate by creating a real estate bubble. Consuming more, they might be manufacturing less as far as an overall percentage of their GDP. So I try to think of the knock-on effects, and I'm thinking of the United States. You know, currently they're running close to $100 billion a month trade deficit, and a lot of that's coming in from China. And so I'm just thinking, you know, the American consumer going to Target, Walmart, and Home Depot or Lowe's, something like that. What would happen if they weren't able to source as much of their imports or the products, the goods that we just cannot make or we refuse to make here in the United States? You know, if that stops coming in from China, we go somewhere else most likely, but do they have the capacity to fulfill the demand being created by the additional quote unquote money printing in the United States? And if not, what happens to consumer prices in the U.S. as a result of trying to, quote unquote, fix the Chinese economy or their move towards fascism or mercantilism?
Well, it's not to fix the Chinese economy, it's to fix our economy. So whilst you may be able to locate lower priced goods in Target or Walmart, etc., right, you're paying with a credit card. The deficit that the U.S. is racking up is a function of the mercantilism. Mercantilists, it's the economic system is a waterbed where there are consequences of sitting on one side of the bed. Like when your partner sits on one side, you kind of like, you know, all you're seeing. You're seeing, but the impulse, the people jumping on the bed are, you know, are the mercantilists. So, what happens, George, in concrete terms, is that goods made in the United States and elsewhere become cheaper to consume for the Chinese because their currency trades, presently trades around about, 6.4 versus the US dollar, give or take.
I think, I haven't looked at it, but that sounds right.
No, for sure it does, yeah. Back in the day, back in when there was a mini crisis of confidence in the overseas sector, it traded at about 7.3, so it's appreciated over the last 6 years. The renminbi has appreciated from 7.3 to 6.3, 6.4. If it traded at 4.3, China wouldn't be running those massive surpluses, and it would be a massive pay increase to Chinese citizens, and they would spend that money, or they would come and visit even more. You know, that's how the system was meant to work. You know, the U.S. The U.S. was an enabler because of its size, and so they were the ones ultimately that made the difference between entering the WTO, the World Trade Organization, or not. And of course, when I think it was Clinton sanctioned that, I applaud that. That was with the wisdom that it's better to have wealthy neighbors. You know, again, think of the city center blight of the 70s when people. Or earlier, when people left the city centers and went to live elsewhere, and then when you don't have rich neighbors, you got problems. You
know? The same thing's happening today in the U.S.
Yeah.
People moving out of the cities. Of course, you know, you see the degradation of the city centers. I mean, I'm seeing that in Phoenix. I'll be seeing that tonight. I mean, as we speak.
And also, you'll be seeing, because again, remember. That these empty buildings, these shells, these condominiums are not found just in China. You know, it's not half of Manhattan, but there are large stretches of Manhattan which are vertical, you know, condominium skyscrapers, which are investments which bid up the price, empty blocks which bid up the price and make it impossible to live there. It's a malign influence. So where we're very vulnerable, George. Where we're very vulnerable is that the world of macro was always looking for the last great macro event, arguably, was the late 1990s, where the Asian tigers became vulnerable. They were vulnerable because their currencies became overvalued, and they were overvalued because their growth rates were unsustainable. And, you know, and there were some internal economic macro kind of prudential rules that they were kind of disobeying. And so their problem was that their currency was high and it was most likely to fall. And ultimately it crashed. You know, they resisted, and then the wall fell down. The issue today, which is more intractable, is what happens when currencies are too low. Because it's very hard for the dollar to unilaterally devalue. How does the U.S. unilaterally devalue the dollar versus the renminbi?
It's like a Plaza Accord 2.0.
Yeah, but I don't think there would be a willingness to go along with it. Right. And also because, again, you know, for instance, the Swiss central bank, Switzerland is not fascist, albeit they have petit bourgeois rules. You know, I mean, you get fined if you cross the role. I've been stopped. I've been like cornered. Would you believe I've been cornered by officious Swiss policemen in Geneva? Like, oh, you must wait for the green light. I'm like, I'm busy. What? You know, so they have a petite bourgeoisie. They're fascists in a teacup, but they're not the real deal. But their currency is desperate to be unshackled, to rise further and further in the manner that it did in the 1970s. But with the advent of quantitative easing, the central bank can control it. You know, they own a ton of Apple. They own the NASDAQ. You know, they own U.S. assets. They print Swiss paper and they buy dollar assets. So they're selling the Swiss and they're buying the U.S. dollar. So a currency that logically should's quite a kind of normative term, but you know, rationally, one would have anticipated it would rise. Its flight path has been modestly linear, as opposed to like making a difference.
Right.
So the U.S. has become a serf to the mercantilist because the problem, which was kind of unsketched in the doctrines of macro, was how does the center devalue?
Yeah. So, and then the entity you're talking about is, how does which country devalue? Is that the country you're talking about?
It needs to be the U.S. It needs to be the U.S. It needs to be the reserve currency.
Right.
So again, what was the reserve currency at the end of the 20s? It was gold. Yeah.
So if dollar goes down to, let's say, 50 in an orderly fashion, that solves a lot of the problems in the world today. I'm talking about the DXY.
If it goes to 70, it solves. You don't have to go. But, you know, why couldn't it trade 70, 75? You could try a little bit of jawboning, but I actually can't. I don't see an international exceptions of that, and I can see how that could be subverted, like I say, by the use of the digital press and the rhetoric of others. But that would be this is why the dollar rises when things are, you know, it's any presumption that the dollar is rising just now because the Fed is likely to raise rates and it seems unlikely that the European Central Bank will follow them. I think that's just, that's such a lame argument. The dollar, if it's to persist in its trend rising higher, is a clarion call of danger. We're taking seriously the disequilibrium in property prices in China. We're taking seriously the lack of real paper printing, money printing by the commercial banking sector. You know, ever since, you know, to quote Jeff Snyder, you know, they've taken a great leave of absence. There's been, you know, back to Ayn Rand, there's been a disappearing of those responsible for taking calculated commercial risk to lend money to commerce and households in the Western world.
It gives me a lot to think about there, because as you're saying that, as far as the dollar going down to 75, I'm looking at Josh here. I'm thinking about the IMF, and I did a video on that. That takes a lot of leverage away from the IMF with emerging markets. And there's just, I really want to process that. I think that'd be a good whiteboard video for next week, Josh, for sure.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Are you ready to take some calls, buddy?
Well, I'd love to. I'm fed up listening to me. I'm a narcissist. give me some raw meat.
All right. Josh, we have a... Hello, caller. What is your name?
Sorry, just got the camera there. Terry, how are you doing, lads?
Well, Terry, you're on with Hugh Hendry. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I'm calling from Dublin, Ireland here. Anyway, like your stuff, lads. Listen to a lot of your stuff. Thought your one with Richard Werner a few years ago on Real Vision was very good. And then I know you had him on there as well. I like Richard a lot. I was just checking the DXY graph there while you were chatting there, and see, like, it went down to about 76 there around 2006.
Yep.
So what happened then to get that down to 76 that can't happen now? Like, you know, I know you're talking about that's what needs to happen, and I understand that, but like, what's, you know, that wasn't so long ago. We're not talking about 20s, the devaluation in gold, 33. But like, so what conditions can't be met now to make
great
that happen?
Great question. I congratulate you on that. And the answer is, I want to say the answer is simple, because we had the gold standard, then we had the bread and wood system, and then people talk about the closure of the gold window in, I want to say, 1971. That was kind of that the closure of the gold window really was a function that of us changing onto a private sector organized system of money creation called the Eurodollar system. So again, Jeff Snyder. And we rode a wave of risk taking of commercial banks, but using offshore centers, offshore to the United States, which is why you get this moniker of the Eurodollar, who were making dollar loans back into the US and to places far, you know, far afield, you know, and China, everywhere. But dollars being lent outside, dollars being created outside the purveyance of the Federal Reserve's domain. Okay. And that was a multi-decade phenomenon, and it was an exponential curve. And that was, when you create money like that, you create many things, but you definitely create prosperity. You've got lubrication for the entrepreneur. You can finance dreams and more than dreams, good solid business plans. And it flared out. The flare was the last stage of the flare led to the bankruptcy, or the almost near bankruptcy, of all Western banks. They overcommitted themselves. They took on the conceit and the arrogance of a well-formed idea that the U.S. Housing market, which is made up of, you know, the states of, you know, of Washington and California on the west, to the, you know, to the finance on the east coast, to the oil in Texas, that it was unprecedented to think that all of those states could, the house prices could fall together, and so risk taking became hubristic. And took on too much, and you know, we were on the brink of, you know, the complete elimination of the banking sector. Since then, the growth rate in that money, again, the Federal Reserve, repeat after me, the Federal Reserve does not print money. Does not print money. Private commercial banks print money, and they've been printing money since the great financial crisis, or recession, depression, I call it, but not to the same vigor. And that's why, and again, Jeff's very good at kind of pointing out that, yes, nominal GDP, absolute GDP levels today are higher than they were at the end of 2008 or 2006 or 2007. But if you were to put a trend and carry that trend and look at where we should be versus where we are, globally, we could be missing as much as $10 trillion in terms of world income, which is why we have fascists, because, you know, when you take $10 trillion out of the system, people recognize it. So quantitative easing is this big kind of fig leaf. It's kind of like, we're doing something, lads, but they're doing nothing. They're doing nothing. And so the problem we have, we'll be stuck that way until we need a kind of revision in terms of, you know, like I say, we had gold. Gold had its problems. Bread and wood had its problems. We've discovered that the Eurodollar system has its problems. And just now it's an impasse as we await something else. So when that money was full on, good things were happening. And the dollar is weak when good things happen. And the dollar rises when there's fear. Why does it rise? Because the dollar becomes precious, because everyone else in the rest of the world has loans outstanding, which are backed, or they've got to repay dollars. So dollars become precious and rare at that point, and the price gets bid up. So that's the reason. It's a fundamental shift in the expansion of the Eurodollar money creating process, which peaked, I want to say, when did you say, 2006, with the dollar at 76?
Yeah, it was around that time, not exact, but 2006, and, 2007, around that time, yeah.
And again, Terry, this is why, again, I'm a paradoxical thinker. So again, the absurdity is that the U.S. central bank claims wrongly to have created $7 trillion. It's a lot. And yet, as you would remark, the dollar has risen in value from 76 to north of 96. How does that happen? You make something more plentiful and this price rises? Are you sure you're telling us the truth?
Right.
But is that not just a relative game, like, because, you know, the ECB is, that hasn't stopped. Like, I think that their rate of increase is marginally higher than the US.
I think the shifting sand in a box.
I think, yeah, first of all, brilliant question and brilliant answer. I think that you've got to look at the magnitude of the euro dollar market compared to the magnitude of the markets for, let's just say, fiat currency. And let's just say the dollar domestically within the United States, the euro within the eurozone, the yen in Japan and outside. And if you look at the euro dollar system, let's say that there's $80 trillion worth of activity. You know, that's the market, the circulation of the amount of fiat currency units. Whereas, let's just say, just hypothetically, within the United States, it's $20 trillion. Within the eurozone, let's say with euros, it's maybe, let's say, $20 trillion. Japan, maybe $10 trillion. So it's not that those markets don't matter. They're definitely cross currents there. But whatever, because of the size of the euro dollar market, whatever that is doing is most likely going to be the most powerful cross current. Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense. I have a few more questions, or did you have to kick me off? Or
yeah, well, quickly, yeah, we got a bunch of people waiting to talk to Hugh.
All right, another quick question. So, just related to this one. So, when you're talking about the euro dollar market, if there's two parties in the transaction for a euro dollar contract, and how does that actually, so if I write, I agree to pay in dollars, but I don't actually have the dollars. So I've entered that contract and I just keep on rolling that contract over per se in the same sort of same terms at the maturity or before the maturity. How would that impact DXY? Does it push it up or push it down?
Because there's a shortage of dollars. See, you got to look at the way I understand this in my own mind. Is when Snyder or when Hugh says there's a shortage of dollars, Brent says this all the time too. I think that there's a shortage of dollar cash flow to service dollar denominated debt. So to your point, you know, if you've got that loan, you're Evergrande, right? And you need to roll over your dollar denominated debt because you don't have the dollar cash flow to make those payments. Well, if the euro dollar system is humming along, then you can roll over that debt. There's liquidity. But if it's frozen, if it's not, if it sees risks out there, then it's not going to provide those dollars that lubricates the global economy. That's kind of how I see it in my mind. And therefore, dollar goes up.
Okay. Just I'll leave you a last thought. Just get this in here. Just one thing that when you're talking about bonds and yields all the time, there's something that's never brought up. I'm an actuary myself. So work with bonds and insurance liabilities and assets, match them and stuff. And there's a certain percentage there for bonds, obviously it's the same. I'm not sure the US regulations, but in Europe anyway, there's always buyers, guaranteed buyers there just by the regulations. So for all the life insurance liabilities, they don't care what fucking yields are at all. Excuse the person. Yields on them at all. They're guaranteed buyers all the time. And there's something that's linked to that as well, is that the property market goes higher. The life insurance that you have to take out is higher as well. So it's even an increased demand for bonds on that in a nominal sense as well. And I don't hear that being discussed, and the kind of the breakdown of the bond market, like how much are guaranteed buyers, like insurers, regardless of whatever happens, they're never going to be selling. So right. I think that's something interesting to think about as well. I don't know the breakdown myself, but just it's an interesting kind of angle.
I completely agree. Yeah, fantastic insights, man. That's really awesome. Thank you for calling in.
Cheers. Thanks, Mads. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Hey, there he is. What's going on, buddy? You're on with Hugh Hendry.
Hey, how are you both? So I just really had a quick question, and it's for both of you guys, actually. I just wondered, like, for people that have the luxury of escaping authoritarianism, where's the best place to go? Where's the best countries, the lesser evil?
Yeah, Hugh, what do you think? Well, you've been traveling a lot lately, I think, haven't you?
I'm here. I dare to say I'm something of a thinker. And I became disillusioned by the course that we seem set upon in the political economy. And again, if I go back to Ayn Rand, I didn't want to waste my best efforts fighting it. Mm. I wanted to evade it because, again, I feared the tyranny of the many against the few. And so right. I sought out an absolutely tiny, this island of St. Bart's in the French West Indies is 11 kilometers. We have like a permanent population of 10,000 people. We're beaten up by hurricanes every year. But it's bliss. It's heaven, apart from the fact we've got these damn gendarmerie and they're like up my ass with all these vaccine rules. But anyway, it's a
and
place.
Mosquitoes are kind of annoying too.
Yeah. But George, I've got a new treatment, and these guys are, I don't know what smoke they're blowing, but I've perked up and there are no mosquitoes, I tell you.
Great. Gives me more of a reason to go back.
No taxes. I don't like the Caribbean. I want to say, and I shouldn't say, but it's an awful place. I wouldn't choose to live in the Caribbean. St. Barnes is not the Caribbean. A society with no taxes, with no government debt, with no crime.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I chose.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. And I've, as you know, I was there in probably a couple months in 2022 or 2020. I'm sorry. Yeah. And yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. It's just the people are wonderful. The food is incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, my goodness, it's really kind of that. It's like going long volatility in your personal life. And it's you now as far as from my perspective, I think that's a great option right now. Mm-hmm. In the United States, there are places that I think are really good options, such as Florida, mm-hmm. such as Texas, such as Arizona and a couple other states in there. But the places where you can find freedom and liberty, they are far and few between. But I think I see light at the end of the tunnel. That's the good news. I think moving into the summer, we're going to see places get less draconian as far as their restrictions towards COVID. Now, I think that's just going to buy us time until they come out and try to take advantage of the next crisis, whatever that may be. And now more people are conditioned to be okay with sacrificing their freedom and liberty. But I do see kind of a short-term light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, that's good.
I don't share that optimism. I don't share that. I call it the F times. And they have pages given over to their self-appointed intellectuals, who are just the most awful of the moochers. And daily they are delighting in talking about the need to keep these rules, to keep them, not to take them off, to keep them.
Yeah.
Once you make a man powerful, he's kind of reluctant to give you back the guns and the barbed wire and everything else. So, well, Lord, I hope I'm
wrong. Lord Acton.
Yeah, and I think in Canada, like I think it's going to be hard to go back for a lot of places. And Quebec, what's happening there with curfews and stuff like that. The thing is, I was explaining to one of my subscribers the other day, they were going full on authoritarian before this crisis hit, because they actually banned religious symbols on public transportation. So it's just like they've just gone full blown now. But the insanity in these leaders' minds is indescribable.
Yeah. All right, my friend. Well, thanks for calling in. Appreciate the question. Hello, caller. What is your name?
Hey guys, this is Mitchell.
Hey Mitchell, do you have a question for my good buddy Hugh Hendry?
Yeah, I did. So I kind of just wanted to hear your opinion on, the benefits of having a second passport and then possibly international real estate investing, just to kind of hedge yourself against government overreach and deteriorating freedoms and liberty, and kind of how you see that from a business and a personal standpoint.
Yeah. Hugh, you want to start?
I can say a little, George, you can say a lot more. It's kind of hard to escape the tyranny of the state. it's impossible to give up your British. It's impossible to give up your British passport, as an example. It's become incredibly hard and financially onerous to give up your American passport. That's not what you are asking. You're saying to supplement it, which I understand. I am in the process of, I have the necessity of needing a residence card to allow me easier access back and forward to where I am today in St. Bart's. So if you wait too long to organize these things, you're going to find the bridges being pulled down. So I think there is a need for forward planning. There is a need to think the worst and hope for the best. Mm-hmm. And within that context, having the legitimacy of, I call them Charlie Wonkers, the chocolate bar with a gold wrapper. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you want to spend your time in the chocolate factory, you better find that Charlie Wonker bar of chocolate.
Right.
Yeah. For me, I can just tell you my own personal story going back to 2020. When I was in Colombia, I got locked down in Medellin, and it was very difficult to get out of the country. I had to wait for a humanitarian flight to Fort Lauderdale, and I was just trying to find any place, quite literally on the planet, where I could just go to the gym, for heaven's sakes, and just have some type of normal life. Mm-hmm. And there were very few places I could actually go with a U.S. passport. Mm-hmm. Now, if I would have had a different passport, it would have made travel quite a bit easier back in 2020. And fortunately, I was able to text Hugh, and he was nice enough to tell me, I remember it well. I think I texted him. I said, "Hugh, are the gyms, plural, open in St. Bart's?" And he said, "You mean the gym?" Yeah, it's open. That tells you how small St. Bart's is. But, it would have been very useful for me to have a second passport then. Now, fast forward to today. Mm-hmm. I'm planning on going back to Medellin in February. Now, Colombia, just came out with a vaccine mandate to get into the country. But that is only applicable for non-citizens. So I do not have my passport for Colombia, but what I do have is an investor visa.
Right.
So with that investor visa, they treat me as though I am a citizen from that standpoint. So if I go to or choose to go to Colombia, I don't have to worry as of right now. I don't have to worry about getting the vaccine, where if you didn't have that visa, you're a gringo or something, you would be caught up in that web of the vaccine mandate. So that just gives you two personal stories as to why it's extremely advantageous. And as my buddy Simon Black says, what's your downside there to have that second passport? There is no downside whatsoever. As far as real estate overseas, mm-hmm. I think it can be very prudent. I think it's a way to go long vol, potentially, especially if you own something in a place like St. Bart's. Also, I think the downside is less in areas where there's not as much debt in the system, like Colombia, where very few people actually have a mortgage on their property. Most people own them outright.
Okay.
But buyer beware, though. You mm-hmm. have to understand that when you're dealing with markets like Colombia, you are playing with fire. And although there's a lot of opportunity there, you have to be a local expert, or you have to partner with people like the crew I have with Angie and Joaquin. If you're just a random gringo that goes down there and just tries to find something online on an English speaking website, mm-hmm. you are going to get your butt handed to you. And 9 out of 10 times, you're going to lose a lot of money, especially if you start bringing in general contractors that are going to basically rob you blind. So I think it's a good idea, but again, just be aware you're playing with fire, and you got to have a lot of local expertise.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate all the content you're giving out. Hugh, I'd love to see a Rebel Capitalist live in Miami.
That's right.
This summer. So thanks, guys.
I can't get into the States without a vax.
Oh, man.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah. Also, they're yeah.
We'll all right. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, everything is possible. Awesome.
Yeah.
And George, we got to talk about your workout regime. You do not have to go to gyms. The next time you come to St. Bart's, I'm going to take you to the beach. If you arrive in St. Bart's and you arrive.
Remember, I was doing a lot of swimming with Mike. Is Mike still there?
I've no idea. My gym is the beach. And
no, but remember, Mike and I were swimming. We were going out to those cliffs.
Oh, Mike, yes.
What's the beach there? What was the beach called where we were having drinks and where you can swim out to the cliff?
Shell Beach,
that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, he took me there and I almost died. But then every weekend after that, I was going out there to really practice my ocean swimming. And that's one hell of a workout.
That is a good workout, yeah. Well, if you fly into St. Bart's and you cast an eye to the right-hand side of the runway as you come in over the sea, which is the unconventional way, if you see some geezer dressed in black working out on the sand, it's me.
All right, Hugh. Well, on that note, we'll go ahead and let you go. Thanks a lot for your time and taking those calls. I know everyone really cherishes the opportunity to get to ask you a question. But for my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, your podcast, where can they go?
Oh, please, because, you know, it's hard to, you know, the genius is trying to compress all of your knowledge into like a 10-second TV soundbite, you know. Yeah. But come to Instagram, Hugh Hendry Official, because it's Twitter's wonderful. I love Twitter, but it's like drops of snow landing on the desert. Once you've released something, boom, it's gone, it's disappeared. Whereas I can track and see every comment, and I'm using Instagram today as a stream of consciousness, and I'm kind of reaching out to everyone. I want the feedback and I respond to everyone. And then weekly, I'm trying to put out podcasts now. So again, under the moniker of Hugh Hendry Official. So I welcome you all. I'm keen to engage with you.
All right, Hugh. Appreciate your time. I can't wait to do it again, my friend.
Thank you, George. You're the best.